In the news.
Hello, I'm Professor McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project, not Darren Shaw, having gone to a Bernie Sanders rally.
And welcome to In the News for Introduction to American and Texas Government. So this week we have with us Dr. Henson, who again is the director of the Texas Politics Project. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
So we kind of want to just jump right into it this week. Again, the second exam was finished yesterday. Things looking good. And so let's talk about what's in the news. So one of the first things that jumps out is that the Trump administration has received another kind of rebuttal in its attempt to remove the Deferred Action Program, or DACA. And so in a second order, a federal judge has argued that stated the Trump administration must reinstate DACA and but has given them 20 days to figure out if they want to appeal again. And so it looks like DACA is safe for another day, but the fight is still going on. And so again, if you think about this, this deals with the individuals who were brought over as children, who have basically either gone to college, served in the military, and allowing them to stay within the U.S. even though they're undocumented and their entry into the U.S. was illegal. So this is something that's kind of been going on, and it's not really sure how long the Trump administration is going to keep fighting this. Dr. Henson, you've done quite a bit of looking at public opinion towards DACA. What do you think?
Public opinion on this is interesting for the Trump administration. In a lot of ways, immigration and border security, Donald Trump's signature issue, and a signature issue for Republican candidates really going back before Donald Trump. You were saying that DACA has been around for a long time. I mean, the Obama administration was fighting over DACA for, the last, few years of his two terms. It's been an issue in terms of public opinion. It's not really as much of a winner for Republicans and for the Trump administration as other aspects of immigration and border security policy. It's one of those areas where public opinion among Republicans in particularly is not as solidly opposed to DACA and not as, quote unquote, anti-immigrant or restrictive on immigration as it is in other areas. So, they're kind of stuck with it. It almost feels to me like it was one of the early commitments of the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. They don't want to give up on it, but it's just they're getting, sort of dragged through the ringer on this because they're having a hard time getting rid of it, which is what they promised their voter.
Yeah, and it's very sticky. I mean, as you can see, you have individuals who, clearly on with the Democrats, they're very strong supportive. And again, you don't have strong. You may have opposition, but not intense opposition from the Republicans. And so going after this, and again, when you start sending these individuals away, that's when you're going to see a great deal, I expect to see a great deal of pushback. So it's going to be interesting to see, what happens with DACA going forward. Now, the second thing we want to move to is dealing with automobile emissions. And so the Trump administration has tried to relax many of the guidelines put forward for automobile emissions, and in particular is try to repeal a waiver the state of California has that, again, part of what was under the Obama administration, but another part of the waiver goes back to the passage of the Clean Air Act. And what this does is allows California to set really stricter emission standards. So California, going back to the passage of the Clean Air Act, because it was really one of the first movers dealing with clean air, Congress allowed it to set its own emission standards. Other states cannot set their own emission standards, but they can adopt California emission standards. So if you ever watch a game show and it says the car has California emissions, basically it's saying that the state of California has established its emission standards and it meets those emission standards for the state of California. So you have 12 other states, including the District of Columbia, which have adopted California's emission standards. So while other states cannot adopt their own standards, they can copy what California is doing. And on top of that, dealers in states, neighboring states that have adopted California emissions can sell cars with California emissions. So what you're seeing here is that because of this, cars with California emissions make up about 40% of the market share when it comes to new automobile sales. So California is able to dictate a large portion of the automobiles sold in the U.S. And so there has been this pushback from the automotive industry to try to repeal the amount of power California has. They believe that California has way too much power, and the power that California has given it is not necessarily fair to other states and maybe imposing burdens on other dealers. But this is an interesting story about federalism, and I think, you know, Dr. Hanson, you had an interesting analogy regarding this.
Well, it's interesting, the history of federalism, you know, for most of our lives anyway, and we're old people, but the history of federalism has been usually about the federal government trying to impose more standards, more regulations, more demands on the states, and the states pushing back, wanting fewer restrictions, lower levels. Because of the politics of this issue and, frankly, the science of global warming and the nature of, you know, where cars are and the environmental problems in California, this kind of flips that in that what we're seeing is a state fighting to have to do the more regulation themselves and the federal government trying to pull back on these regulations. And I think, you know, the politics you were talking about for the car and even the economics for the car industry are going to be interesting. The Attorney General of California, Javier Becerra, has already said they will file suit against the federal government to stay this and hopefully reverse the order from their perspective. Either way, this gets tied up in the court. And so what the auto industry is going to wind up with is probably more uncertainty rather than less because of the litigation that's going to come out of this.
Yeah, and it's a very tricky situation. And again, many of you may not remember this, but California was really known for its pollution, specifically Southern California. So if you think of the term smog, which is kind of the mixture of basically automobile emissions plus the atmosphere, where you got this gray haze or really brown haze over the city where you really couldn't see anything. And basically it was a fog created from vehicle emissions, but then other pollutants in the air. And so this is what Southern California became known for, specifically Los Angeles, and extremely poor air quality. I know of one individual who would talk about driving to California, had really bad asthma, and would talk about driving down to Southern California. It seemed like as soon as he hit LA, he would pass out because he couldn't breathe properly. And it took him a couple days to be able to breathe. And so this is really part of the history, especially in the early 70s regarding California, and where you see them really making this very strong push. Because you have the second largest city in the U.S. with horrible air quality. So if you think about the way they talk about air quality in China, well, that's what California looked like in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California the 70s, and you know it was smog alerts, and we moved inland, and basically, you know, L.A. is in a basin. And, you know, you get what you call the inversion layer because the differential temperature, the smog comes in, and because of the way the geography and the temperature, it just sits there until the sea breezes blow it out, and then it blows it out into the eastern part of the bowl. And so those areas out there, Riverside, Eastern LA County, you know, were just horrible. And if you went up in the mountains, you could look down and you could actually see the flat level of smog that just filled the basin. And it was, and it's, you know, significantly started getting better about the time I left.
It's one of those weird things. So it's not necessarily the fact that Californians were just driving these horrible cars. It was a mixture of things. So if you think of why Hurricane Katrina was so bad in New Orleans, it was a combination of, well, New Orleans is like a bowl, and so the water just came straight in and stayed there because it's below sea level. And with California, it's just with Los Angeles, because it's in the basin, it's just the natural, like the dust, things like that from the farms kind of blow in and just settle down there. And so all of these things factored into this, but the one thing they could control was vehicle emissions. And so that's one of the things they pushed forward. But the Trump administration is trying to basically relax the amount of power that California has within this. And so this is, again, a fight about federalism. And so you could argue this is a fight about rights, the right to free air, things of that nature. But also it's a fight about federalism. Really, who controls this? Does the state control this? Does the federal government control this? There's a past agreement that allowing this state this control, but can it have that much control? And we also see these fights come out where California has tried to have a little bit more control with things such as its ports. So it's tried to make its own international deals or pacts in order to bring business into its ports and in many ways supersede the federal government. And so many times states will say, look, we know it's in our best interest. Allow us to negotiate this, because if you negotiate this, it'll be bad for us. So it may look good for you or the people who are involved, but it may be bad for us. And so sometimes the federal government does allow states these freedoms. But as we can see in the case of California, by allowing these freedoms, it has allowed the state of California to have a what many people would argue is a disproportionate effect on the automobile industry. And whether this is good or again, I think the automobile industry would argue this is a bad thing, whereas those who support environmental issues believe it's a great thing, given how important environmentalism is in the state of California, where even, you know, the conservatives in California are really big on environmentalism, because Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was governor of California, you know, Republican governor of California, actively lobbying Congress to pass stricter emission standards for vehicles. So it's, you know, if you're in Alabama, you must love football. If you're in California, you must love the environment. So, you know, nobody's going to run for office in California saying, hey, we need lower pollution standards. So it's just not going to fly.
Well, and partisanship really enters into this in a funny way, sitting here, you know, in Texas, you know, for the 8 years of the Obama administration, it was Texas suing the federal government over various provisions, including DACA, to tie everything together. And then the partisan, you know, identity in the White House and in Washington changes. And now we're not suing Texas isn't suing the federal government anymore. Now it's California, democratically run state, suing the federal government. So, you know, your kind of view of federalism is also often colored by partisanship.
Who's
where?
Yes, it's very clear. You know, Texas was suing the federal government over. I mean, if you look at the Supreme Court cases coming out, in which you saw a battle between the states and the federal government, Texas was leading the way. Sometimes Texas would win, sometimes Texas would lose. Now that you have a Republican in office, I mean, even when George W. Bush was in office, Texas was suing a lot. But Texas seems to
it
be kind of.
It took a while for them to get there.
Yes, yeah. And so it's. Texas seems to be the stalwart for defending conservative states, or I think California and New York are defending the more liberal states.
The governor of Texas, when he ran for Texas, part of his appeal to conservatives was that his attorney general, what he did was he got up in the morning and thought about how he was going to sue the federal government today.
That's right. And so, again, you hate the federal government when it's not your group in charge. So that's one of the things we need to remember about these things. The federal government's great when it's your folks, but when somebody else's folks, oh no.
Oppressive.
The federal government's oppressive. So moving on from this discussion, what I want to talk about are, I guess, the isms that have popped up within the discussion of American politics. And so in particular, we want to talk about socialism, populism, and fascism. These are three terms that have been used quite a bit. You're hearing people say, you know, the rise of socialism, specifically within the Democratic Party, the use of populism on the part of Bernie Sanders, as well as President Trump, then also fascism. So President Trump has been accused of being a fascist. What exactly are these things? And so we want to spend a little time talking about each of these. And so the first one to start off with is really a discussion of socialism. So we have a video that talks about socialism, specifically democratic socialism.
Here in America, where capitalism reigns supreme. We want our businesses and economic markets to be freer than a bald eagle flying through the sky eating a Big Mac. But clearly, the stigma of socialism is lifting as one of our presidential contenders, Bernie Feel the Burn Sanders, has brought socialism, and in particular democratic socialism, to the forefront of the national conversation. Socialism at its root stands for the belief that a group of people can work together for the betterment of all the members of that population, not just for the benefit of the few. Not to be confused with its more extreme totalitarian form, communism, socialism isn't about how much the government controls, but that its people control and share its resources. Democratic socialism is the enactment of socialist principles through the means of the democratic process. Democratic socialists believe that the government and the economy should be run by the people it is representing, rather than a small handful of people working against the interests of the majority. So it makes sense that socialism is making a sort of comeback here in America, right? Thanks to unfettered capitalism, the top one-tenth of the 1% wealthiest people in this country now own more wealth than the bottom 90%. CEOs are making 300 times what their workers make, and some aren't even giving their workers livable wages or benefits. Now, you may be looking at me right now and saying, well, yeah, he's just a communist. But I assure you, I am not a communist, I'm just a millennial. And we love socialism. And what a lot of people may not realize is that America is kind of already a socialist country. Think about it. Medicare, free K-12 education, the Postal Service, even the Army are all socialist programs. Hell, if you drive on a road or a highway, you're utilizing socialism. Yet it still remains to be seen if socialism will catch on with Americans enough to elect a boisterous democratic socialist to the executive office. Jaded from the Cold War and weary of bigger and more costly government programs, it seems like democratic socialists have more work to do to move past the stigma created against socialism in this country. And Americans only need to look to other countries to see that socialist parties can thrive and work in conjunction with capitalists to have a free market that works for everyone. The important thing to remember is that there are good and bad things about both socialism and capitalism, and that we only need to strike the right balance to make them both work.
All right, so that video was an attempt to get people to understand a little bit more about what socialism is, because usually when people think of socialism, they automatically conflated with communism. And so what we have up here on the screen right now is really a definition of socialism. And so a political theory of social organization that advocates that the means of production, distribution, and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole. And so the idea here is that the means of production, things of that nature, are kind of controlled by or dictated by the community. And so the people have a little bit more say in what is going on. Now, communism, on the other hand, is a political theory in which all property is publicly owned and each person works and is paid according to their abilities and needs, usually organized under a party-led state. Now, under communism, there's this idea of no private property, that the state controls everything, and usually a one-party state. And so there's no competition. And if there is any competition, it's within one party. And so because of this, it's seen as very totalitarian, and it really restricts a lot of voices. Democratic socialism, so this is what you see coming out of Bernie Sanders. You see with a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the kind of the new wing or the emerging wing within the Democratic Party, argues the government is dedicated to the development of socialist society, build an economy through government policy. And so the idea is the government plays a more active role in the economy. It does not get rid of private property. It does not get rid of capitalism, but it plays a much stronger role. So if you think of Denmark, Finland, New Zealand, Canada, these are nations in which you could think of as democratic socialist nations. And again, as the video pointed out, there are clear examples of socialism within the U.S. So if you think of Medicare, so when you reach a certain age, everybody receives something. So we all contribute to Medicare, and you know, a large number of individuals receive this. Social Security. So there are examples of socialism that exist already, but because socialism is so strongly linked to communism, and because of the Cold War, and because really the totalitarian aspects of communism, people are very scared because they think of this as the government coming in and taking over. Whereas Bernie Sanders and other socialists say, no, it's not the government coming in and taking over, it's the government coming in to try to work to create a much fairer economy. So you're still going to have individuals who have large amounts of wealth, you have individuals with less amounts of wealth, but it's in many ways it's an attempt to try to decrease the wealth inequality. And one of the reasons why you see this really take, why you see things like socialism and communism, things like this take off, is this fear that workers are being exploited. And so that you are putting in a lot amount of work and you're not getting as much out of it. And that certain individuals are being rewarded much more for what they contribute than what you contribute. And so in many ways, it's trying to create some type of or reduce the inequality. They realize inequality is going to exist no matter what, but it's the amount of inequality that people are worried about. And so not to say that socialism is the fix to all things. It has numerous problems. So it's great in theory. And many times it has failed in practice. And while you're seeing many socialist democratic nations, you're beginning to see them kind of pull back and reduce the size of government and move things into private hands. But socialism is a little bit more, it's more than communism. Communism is a subset of socialism. In many ways, you could say it's kind of the crazy uncle of socialism. But the problem is we think of socialism and communism as being the same, when in fact they are highly distinct.
It's interesting to me that we're having this discussion again. I mean, yeah. Again, we get to feel like old guys again, I think. But, you know, you mentioned something about how the Cold War in the United States led to this idea of how this kind of conflation between socialism and communism is sort of the same thing. That it's almost as if for a long time in the United States, particularly during the Cold War, you couldn't talk about socialism without, you know, the specter of communism, you know, hovering over it, and the association was kind of unbreakable. And it's interesting now, in this moment, to see socialism making something of a comeback into mainstream discourse, and yet we're still seeing that hangover from the Cold War. I mean, if you listen to, people that are running against farther left Democratic candidates, or when Bernie Sanders was so prominently in the race, pretty common to call anybody that says they're a democratic socialist a communism, or, you know, Ted Cruz has said of some of these left candidates, you know, I know what happens in a socialist country. He's talking about Cuba. And so that association still has this kind of political charge, even though it's a little bit archaic and it's kind of draining off.
Yes.
But it's not gone.
No, it's not gone. And I think the key thing that Sanders and other democratic socialists would argue is that communism is a one-party system that controls everything. Within a democratic socialist system, you want party competition. So you want party competition really dictating, okay, how much should the government be involved in this, how much should the government not be involved in this. Also, they don't believe in the idea of the government taking away private property, as you've seen happen in the former Soviet Union, you've seen happen in China and Cuba. They believe that, you know, people should still have private property, but in terms of kind of dictating the rules of, right, of transactions, things of that nature, is in many ways to try to make sure that workers are not exploited. That's what they're trying to get across. However, because of the specter of communism, and I mean, again, if you think about a 60-year effort to, I want to say necessarily propaganda, but I guess to some degree it is propaganda, to paint communism as the worst thing ever, you know, again, be truthful, yeah, it wasn't that great. It sucked. But this effort to attack communism and to link socialism to communism makes it very difficult. And so in many ways, it's the same thing where, and again, Professor Shell's talked about this, where we talk about, you know, the Supreme Court making certain decisions which may make it a little bit more difficult for certain individuals to vote, in theory, where people automatically think, oh my goodness, we're going back to Jim Crow. And so you associate these two things, and so you may get it seen as an overreaction, but it's been kind of deeply ingrained in terms of our understanding. Now, the second term we want to talk about is fascism. And so you hear a lot of people talking about these anti-fascist groups. Well, if they're anti-fascist, first of all, what is a fascist? And so fascism is a political appeal focused on a community decline, national humiliation, or victimhood that promises to remedy this through unity, energy, and purity. And so what you see coming out of fascism, and really the first nation to adopt fascism would be Italy under Mussolini, and so this took rise around World War II, is this idea of purity of the nation, that the nation has fallen on hard times, and because of some impure group. And so we must now push this group out by any means necessary. And so again, it calls for a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants, abandons democratic liberties. And so you quell or try to crush any type of opposition. And the idea pursue with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints, goals of internal cleansing or external expansion. And so with this, you kind of get what people see as kind of the evil of government, where people kind of get riled up and say, this group has hurt us, we must chase them out. So if you think of Italy, if you think of the Nazis, these are examples of fascists, all right, where they called for an issue of purity. So purifying Italy, purifying Germany by pushing these impure groups out. And again, this authoritarian leader, whether it be Hitler in Germany or Mussolini in Italy, this idea of a strong man who's going to lead us, lead the nation back to its pure roots. And so this is what fascism is. And people throw it out there all the time, like you're a fascist. Well, is it really that? No. People just use fascist all the time as an insult. But let's actually understand what fascism is. And again, if we think of fascism, we think of these groups of arguing of, you know, the nation is on decline and we must redeem ourselves by getting rid of these bad people. And we must get rid of these bad people no matter what. And so we must suspend all types of habeas corpus, any types of rights that they have in order to get them out. And a lot of times it's centralized one figure who's extremely authoritarian. And so you see, again, attempts to stop, to crush opposition, crush the press, especially if they're in opposition, to kind of get this through.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about fascism also kind of coming back into vogue is as a term of art or a term of, you know, sort of political accusation. I mean, unlike socialism or even communism to some degree, the incidents in which people stand up and say, you know what, I'm a fascist, come join our stuff, you know, come join our group, come join our movement, is pretty minimal. I mean, it just doesn't, there's not, it's been pretty thoroughly delegitimized. But I think what's useful about the definition we're using is that you can look at it, and you were sort of doing this, and see where the elements are that if people are going to, you know, people that have their own anxieties from the left about what's going on right now, they look at, you know, this sense of grievance that seems to be so activated, you know, frankly, among a lot of people that have been attracted to Trump, whether, you know, calling Trump himself a fascist is, you know, pretty much a bridge too far given, you know, the technical definition of fascism. But, you know, as you said, you know, the sense of, you know, something in the past that needs to be corrected. Mm-hmm. This idea that, you know, we've lost national purpose and national unity, and that, you know, there's something extraordinary in the moment about that that requires powerful leadership is what people are hanging this on. And it's, again, I think it's kind of a bridge too far. But you can definitely see why somebody might line out those elements and make a graph and go, well, there's a little of this going on, and yes, there's a little of this going on, and there's a little of this going on. And then you make the leap. It's not unlike the socialism, communism thing.
Yeah, and so, again, we're getting these two terms thrown out there, but the issue is make sure you know what they are. And I think this is the problem that I've found, that when we talk about fascism and we talk about socialism, people don't really agree, don't really say, okay, what exactly is this? And so in many ways, they're talking across each other. And so to call somebody who's a socialist a communist is problematic. To call someone a fascist is problematic because really, do you even know what a fascist is? And so, I mean, I find myself doing this all the time. I'm saying, when they call somebody this, like, well, what is that? Well, then don't use that term. All right? If you don't know what the term means, don't use it. But we kind of think we understand it, but we really don't. And so my hope is that when you're seeing all these things being put out there, you have an idea of what it actually is. And it's common for a lot of terms that are understood with amongst academics or even understand political elites, that when they get into the mainstream public, that they get misinterpreted. And so our way of understanding it, it can be changed drastically, and it becomes part of just everyday conversation. The true meaning of the term gets lost. And so this leads us to the last term, populism. So populism, and so this is taken from another work. And so we're kind of this populism short introduction. This is a thin-centered ideology that considers society to be ultimately separated into two homogeneous and antagonistic groups, the pure people versus the corrupt elite, and which it argues that politics should be an expression of the general will of the people. And so one of the things about this is you can easily see how populism can be turned into fascism, or people can see a link between that. Just as we can see a link between how socialism can turn into communism, populism, people, when people use populist rhetoric, they can easily be accused of fascism because, again, this idea of the pure people and a corrupt elite or some type of corrupt group. And so if you think about the populism, you see this coming from Bernie Sanders as well as from President Trump, is that Senator Sanders talks about the corrupt elite and specifically the economic elite. When President Trump ran for office, he talked about the corrupt elite, specifically the political elite. So either the mainstream Republican Party, the mainstream Democrats, these are the ones who had corrupted us and cheated the nation. And so what you find is populism is usually coupled with another ideology. So if you think of Bernie Sanders, his populism is coupled with socialism. If you think of President Trump, his populism was coupled really with a kind of a nationalist ideology. And again, the anti-establishment, highly emotional, okay? And again, one of the things about it is emotions matter. When people get angry, they are more likely to act. All right. So if you get them scared, they're more likely like, we got to find a way to solve this. Or so they're going to look to somebody to give them answers. And when they're angry, they're more likely to act. They're more likely to go to the polls. So happy people, I'm good. Why should I vote? If you're angry, oh, no, we're going to fix this right now. All right. And again, think about the number of times in which you've been angry and you've acted. All right. Again, one of the things we know about anger is that when people are angry, they can't really calculate things very well. All right, so think about that time, all right, when you had an older sibling or something like that who really made you angry, all right, and you was ready to fight. All right, I think about it, I got a cousin who's 6 years older than me, all right. He did something, it really upset me, I got really angry. I was like, no, I'm gonna fix this now. All right, so I went up and I confronted him. And then when I woke up 2 hours later, I realized, oh, I should have thought that through a little bit better. But again, anger gets people to act, all right. Anger gets people to act, and so you want to apply, you want to focus on this emotionalism. Then on top of that, conspiratorial aspects where you think there's a secret group working behind the scenes. You see the same thing on the right as well as the left. So right now you're going through the lectures on public opinion, and you'll see in those public opinion lectures, I talk about conspiracy theories and where do they come from. And again, when you see this idea of a pure group and an evil group, that's where you're more likely to see conspiracy theories come about. And again, also this idea of popular sovereignty, that the people should have a lot to say, has to have a very strong say in this. Now, I've said a lot, but Dr. Henson here has actually done quite a bit on populism. So can you
shed some light? Well, I mean, I think what's interesting about populism is that, you know, there's this valorization, there's the kind of elevation, as you say, of the will and the value of the common person and the people. And that can just be filled in with whatever kind of ideological content or specific content you want. And that tends to be really historically and geographically specific. So, you know, in this moment, we're seeing different forms of populism that tend to be mostly more conservative, nationalist forms of populism. The Trump movement and his success in the United States, in several European countries. What's different, I think, about the United States, there's, you know, one thing is that in a two-party system, you know, populism has a hard time finding a permanent home, even though it's kind of out there and it sort of sporadically raises its head, sometimes on the left, sometimes on the right. So, you know, when you talk about populism in Texas, there's a lot of kind of old-time Texas liberals that get, frankly, kind of pissed off when you talk about it the way we're talking about it, because to them, populism is the populist party that started in Texas in the late 19th century and lasted very briefly into the early 20th century, that was about fighting the railroads and business for the agrarian interests and for the common person. And when you start talking about other forms of populism, they get, you know, uncomfortable and, or, you know, kind of pissed because you're devaluing their historic, deeply rooted populism. But there's also been conservative populism in the history of Texas and in the United States as well. So I think, you know, the interesting thing is to notice populism as this kind of ideological thing that happens, that seizes people either through anger or through fear or through what's in the air at a historical moment that people can use to appeal to the will of the people. Mm-hmm. But you can kind of pour a lot of different things into it, depending on, you know, the skills of the leader and what's going on in the environment at the time.
Yeah. So again, these are important concepts, and they're not static in the sense that only one group can be populist, only one group can be fascist, only one group can be socialist. It changes. And right. So populism, again, as we talked about, is kind of a base, but it's usually mixed with something else. And so it's important to understand how these interact with each other and make sure we understand that we're using them properly. Because again, it's so easy for us to get lost in terms of understanding what these terms mean. Because again, one of the things I've noticed is people will talk about them, but never define them.
Right, and I think part of what makes it that a little more endemic in the United States, one could say a lot of different reasons, but one of them, going back, is that we don't have a multi-party system. Mm-hmm. Right? So in other countries where you have a multi-party system because the rules are different and you can support that, you know, you have a consistent socialist party mm-hmm. that's contesting elections, that's in the political system, that's in media, that is in people's lives mm-hmm. in a way that clarifies what they're about.
Yes.
You know, in the United States, you know, socialists have, you know, usually been either shut out of the Democratic Party or trying to express themselves as they are now mm-hmm. inside the Democratic Party. And, you know, the Democrats, despite the position of the opposition, are very unlikely to ever become a proper socialist party in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so you don't get the kind of rootedness in those meetings. So that people grow up knowing, yeah, you know, one of my uncles was in the Socialist Party, or, mm-hmm. you know, my funky cousins were socialists, or they were in the, you know, right-wing nationalist party. They may not call it a fascist party, but they'd have a more fixed sense mm-hmm. of what a fascistic party would look like. You just don't get that in the United States because the parties are such coalition parties.
Yes, and again, it's one of those things where we're trying to make sure that when you do encounter these terms or these concepts, that you understand it, and in many cases, correct people when they're using it incorrectly. So again, speaking of the whole socialist thing, Bernie Sanders actually gave, I think, like a one-hour lecture at Georgetown explaining what it means to be a socialist to try to get rid of the stigma of that. But again, it's very difficult. I don't think anybody's trying to remove the stigma of being a fascist.
I'm guessing he did a better job than the guy that said, no, really, the post office is a good example. I think that's not how I'd try to make the sale.
No. But Medicare is a great example. The VA.
Social Security.
Those are examples of all kinds of examples of socialism. I don't think anybody's going out and trying to defend fascism. Well, I guess you can think of the white supremacist groups yeah. to some extent. Those would be the ones defending fascism. But again, these are things that are out there, but we want to make sure you understand the roots of these things and how we understand them as academics and how really their base definitions before it kind of gets out into the mass public and in many ways may change or people may not fully grasp what the concept is about. So I believe that's all we have. So again, we wish you all a great week and I'll see you next week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.